Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille Wiggy with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. Concepts, thoughts, thinking, figuring it out, understanding, observing. Like we said yesterday, know thyself. It's the key. But you know, one of the places where people don't know themselves the most, and I would say that I do 70% of my programming around the issue of romance and love. Yes, romance and love. What else? I don't think shrinkdom would exist if it weren't for romance and love. I don't think there would be insanity if there weren't romance and love. I don't think there would be neurosis if it weren't romance and love. Somehow it's all tied up, you know? Either you can't get loved or you can get loved, or you love somebody who doesn't love you back, or you love somebody who you thought loved you one minute and the next minute you found out they didn't love you, or you can't get loved by anybody and it makes you want to commit suicide or it makes you depressed or something like that. Love. What a silly, stupid thing for them to have added to this human formula. You know, they could have been so much better off without love than shrinks. Probably without lawyers. We probably would have no lawyers if it weren't for love, because people do things for power. And why do they do things for power? Because they're not loved. I mean, you think the people in our government feel really loved? They don't care about love. They are compensating. That's what it's all about. Violence may be a compensation for the absence of love. Now, this is stupid, because the human design was pretty good. Two arms, two legs, symmetry, you know, as much as possible. Usage of tools, nice thing. Learning to build fire, good thing. You know, still being able to run, good thing. Working out in gyms to keep your muscles going, good thing. Getting rid of predators, good thing. You know, I mean, humans, the human design, a pretty decent design. But this love stuff, it's a mistake. Well, maybe it's not a mistake. I mean, because the reward is so good, you know. I mean, on the good side, when you got it, it's pretty good stuff. But when you don't have it, it's pretty miserable stuff. And when I say you don't have it, I mean when you love it, when you lose it. Or when you love somebody who doesn't love you back. Or when you think somebody loved you and it turned out they were just using you as a bookmark. What does that mean? This is Armand DeMille with you as a positive mind. We're going to talk about love today. I'm going to talk about a few different aspects of love that you don't know about. The stalker. We haven't talked enough about the stalker. There has been a recent governmental study on stalking, and it was finally released in the Journal of Forensic Scientists. And it is a government thing that made stalking illegal in practically every country now. California became the first state to criminalize stalking in 1990. All 50 states have followed suit. Stalking is one of the great horrors of life. What is a stalker? A stalker is somebody who's, you know, just think about the word stalking comes from animal on a hunt. You know, what is the term comes from the word describing the phase of hunting prior to the kill, in which a predator tracks and approaches its prey, boxing in the quarry and never letting it out of sight. That's called stalking. Stalking is doing that. You know, there are people who stalk. Do you ever wonder why they do it? Why? Why does a man stalk a woman? If she says, "I'm not interested in you," why does he stalk her? Well, let me give you some of the reasons why. According to some of the research here, who would you imagine? This one's pretty obvious. Women, 4 to 1, are the victims of stalkers. Does that make sense? Women, 4 to 1, the victims of stalkers. Doesn't mean just by men. Women are stalked by women. Romantic women stalk women. So in other words, if you have a relationship, if you have a sexual feelings or some kind of romantic feeling towards a woman who doesn't return your favor, you can stalk them. You're not going to let them up. You're unrelentful. You don't have to be a man to do it. But men are the primary perpetrators of stalking. They account for 94% of the stalkers identified from female victims. 6% are female stalkers of women. 60% of the stalkers identified by male victims are males. Get that? So when a man is stalked, it's usually by another man, 60%. 40% get stalked by women. In the U.S., 8% of women and 2% of men have been stalked at some time in their life. Have you been stalked? Has anyone ever stalked you? Happens a lot to people who are in the public eye, radio hosts, television hosts. You know, we get a bunch of stalkers. Because people, well, we're going to talk about that. It's called erotomania. It's a specific thing where people have a romantic attraction, obsessional romantic attraction, to someone who is unavailable, usually of a status that is considered higher. So it could be a movie star or something like that. That's called erotomania. Back to stalking. Most victims know their stalkers. Only 23% of the female stalking victims were stalked by strangers. Get this, only 23%. They are usually stalked by somebody they went to bed with. Women tend to be stalked by intimate partners defined as current or former spouses, cohabitants, boyfriends, or girlfriends. Overall, 59% of the female victims were stalked by an intimate partner, whereas 30% of the males were stalked by an intimate partner. But, you know, I guess maybe there's fewer intimate partners. But when a man gets stalked by another man, and that means a sexual obsessive love, homosexual, gay attraction, specifically, when that happens, it's only in 30% of the male victims. It's only 30% of the men knew the man. See, whereas in the women, it was 60% of the women knew the man. They'd slept with the man. About two-thirds of all stalking cases last a year or less. So if you know somebody who's being stalked, you can pretty much figure it's going to last a while, and it's going to go about a year, a little under. About a quarter of the cases, 2 to 5 years, and about a tenth, more than 5 years. There are many people who have picked up their belongings and moved to another state because they were victims of being stalked. I mean, what happens? You call the police, you're being stalked, and they say they could take out some kind of a judgment against the person and say stay away, and the person gets fined for not staying away, and they pay the fine. And they stalk you, and where do you think they stalk you the most? Where do you think is the place most likely for a person to be stalked? What would you imagine? Work. Your workplace is a place because you're kind of public, you know what I mean? Supermarkets, second place, and your home because they know you're there. Those are the three most common stalking places. Health clubs have recently become a new place for stalkers. Now, the interesting thing about health clubs is the number of people who stalk in health clubs have not necessarily slept with their partners. There you get this kind of erotic thing that forms just by seeing the partner in their somewhat, you know, less protected clothing. So you see them and you get, you know, crazy for them, and then you just keep after them. Now, the question is, what drives people to become stalkers? Stalkers typically have experienced failures in life, and believe it or not, most of them are out of work. There's something about having time on your hands. You have time on your hands, and you want to be important in some way, and you create something important to you. Now, all obsessions are like that. Obsessions are about time on your hands. If you have obsessions about washing your hands, it's about time on your hands. It's like you're spending time washing time. You're washing your hands. If you're obsessed about locking the door or checking the fire to make sure, checking your gas stove to make sure it's out or your windows are closed, it's time. It takes time to do these. And you're filling time with them. The stalker has little to do in life. They are not important. They feel powerless. But when they could scare somebody, they feel something special. And they have a focus of their life. They tend to be unemployed. They suffer from mental illness, usually, including major depression and a variety of personality disorders. In the Enneagram, I would suspect the five. You know, that scientific kind of withdrawn would be a hell of a stalker. Now, the psychosis, however, which is a person who is not in touch with reality, and by that I mean a person who is really in a bizarre world, psychosis rarely tends to be present in stalkers of regular people, but when it comes to stalkers of celebrities, a great many of them are psychotic, delusional. And that's why you read about, you know, the John Lennon murder was a case of that. And the stalking of David Letterman, who was hassled for so many years. And there are so many people who are, you learn about it. The problem is when you learn about the celebrity stalkers, the publicity surrounding them has tended to distract us from this surprisingly high prevalence in the general population. For every Linda Ronstadt plagued by a stalker, thousands of Marys are similarly traumatized. In 1998, the National Institute of Justice and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention published Stalking in America, the first ever national survey on stalking and its impact based on a representative telephone survey of 8,000 women and 8,000 men. It's just amazing amount of research. And by the way, if you can't stay with us today, 1-800-FYI-CALL is the National Center for Victims of Crime in General. If you're stalked, it's a place to call, 1-800-FYI-CALL. So why do they stalk? I mean, what is it that they think they are doing, and why are they doing it? What do you think is behind in their mind? Well, one thing, I mean, do you think you like to scare somebody? Stalkers love to scare somebody. They love it if you're afraid of them. You see, and it kind of feels real primitive to me. Imagine a lion stalking a deer. And the deer is now trembling. And there is something about the trembling of the deer that incites the lion. It kind of, there's something in that stalking that when the blood goes rushing through your body, it makes the other become even more fierce. You know, you're honing in on your victim. And so fear seems to be very much of a turn-on to stalkers, your fear, the other person's fear. A number of them said that, a number of stalkers who were interviewed said that they believe that through their stalking, they will break down the resistance of the person who, if they gave up their resistance, would admit that they really love them. So let's say you look at somebody and you want to have them. And they say no. And you make up in your mind that if you just stay after them long enough. Have you ever had that happen to you? I'm sure if you're a woman out there in the world, you have had somebody who persists and comes after you. You know, they just won't let you up. They do it in Spain all the time. You know, or in the Greek islands, you know, you go, you just, right? A single woman goes, gets off the airplane, and zoom, they're right after you. You know, it happens. I've seen it happen in a number of the places I've traveled to. And they'll stay with you, and they just stay after you because there you are. You're the meal, you know. This is Armand DeMille. with you at the Positive Mind. A number of stalkers gave the belief that they thought they were destined to be with the victim, to be with that other person, that it was my predestination. You know, that's why the word, whenever I hear soulmates, I get scared. Because if I hear people talking about soulmates, I go, oh, that means you're not going to give up if the evidence is bad. I mean, if you meet somebody for the first time and that person is, they look great and they sound great, but you have a little thing, you notice that off on the side, they tend to growl every now and then. Whenever you say anything they disapprove of, or they play with knives. You could ignore that behavior, you know, but if you've got that kind of out of your mind in love and you say that person is my soul brother, soul sister, soul mate, if you could give yourself that excuse, you ignore all of the evidence of the negative things that you see. You see, so I get worried about soulmates because it's usually an excuse to ignore the information that's telling you stay away. How many of you have had a soulmate? You have a soulmate? It's kind of great when you have it. But afterwards, you look back and you say, oof, I wish I'd gone to Spain. Okay, Destin, one-third of the people that said the stalkers was a way of breaking down the resistance of people because they absolutely believe it. Now, this leads us to another thing in this absolute belief of that the person you're stalking really wants you. I mean, I don't know where you get that idea from, because they're telling you, get away, leave me alone, but then they get frightened. And when they get scared enough, they give you something, a cup of coffee. Okay, I'll go out with you. Okay, a little cup of coffee, a little cup of tea. All right, I'll send you a pair of my underwear. You know, whatever it is that you're going to do, that they're asking you to do because you think it's just a small thing. And it just incites it further and further. Most common stalking activities is being followed, spied on, stood outside your home. The person standing outside your home. The second is unwanted phone calls. Now you have protection on phone calls as well. Because with star 69, which is an unfortunate choice for the returning of calls, but star 69 is going to get you to, you could return the call, or you could identify call identifiers, you could see, you could block calls, you could say, you know, nowadays, so the phone is no longer easy, but emails become possible, now they've learned to block emails. So emails, sent or left unwanted letters or items, vandalized property is another thing, you know, there's something about a stalker, they want to take something of yours, they'll break into your house and take something and you'll be vandalized. And another unfortunate, horrible, terrible thing of an experience with a stalker is they almost, in many, many cases, they threaten to kill your family pet if you don't return their favor. Now, just picture that. You know, just picture the spot it puts you in. If you don't go out with me for a cup of coffee, you know, all right, I'll go out with a cup of coffee. Because you can't hurt Athena. Okay, so the mainly they want to control it, and this is the stalker. This is one form of romantic obsession. So how about you, my friends? Have you ever been romantically obsessed? Have you ever been in that kind of spot? Let's talk about some of the phases of romantic obsession. We're going to take your calls a little later today because, believe it or not, it's been a month since I've taken your calls. Hasn't it been a month? It's been a month. A month since we've taken the calls because we've been on the fund drive. And during this fund drive, we raised a lot of money and we asked you people to make donations, and you did, and I want to thank you. And those that did can immediately take advantage of those and make the calls to my office, and we'll give you the what we promised you immediately. You don't have to wait. Okay, now, how do you know when you've developed an unhealthy attachment to another person? You could do it by looking at the phases of romantic attraction, and you could tell what is the phase of your romantic attraction. And here they come. The initial phase is characterized by an instantaneous and overwhelming attraction to another person. It is at this point that the rationally dependent person becomes hooked on a romantic interest, usually resulting from the slightest bit of attention from the person they're attracted to. So this is it. You find somebody and you're gaga. Now, I say that this usually happens when you fall in love like this. It's called falling in love. I call it finding a plus for your minus. I use that expression because it usually means you're feeling some way down, you're feeling negative, and almost everybody I ever know who fell in love dramatically, spontaneously, was feeling low. They were feeling empty. Something happened. They lost a job. They were feeling weak. They were feeling inadequate. They were feeling powerless. Perfect time to fall in love because you find a plus for your minus. It kind of takes away the negative feelings that you have. I call it finding a plus for your minus. So phase one, you find an instant attraction to a romantic interest. It usually happens in the first few minutes of a meeting. An immediate urge to rush into a relationship. We know you are becoming hooked on the look of another person. You look at them and you just can't get away from the look of them. You think they're beautiful, fantastic. Then you have unrealistic fantasies about a relationship with a love interest, giving magical qualities to it, and this is where that romance, the soulmate stuff comes in. And then at the beginning of this phase one, these little obsessive controlling behaviors begin to manifest, especially jealousy. You know, so you're dating someone, you're a woman and you're dating a guy, or you're dating a woman, and two of you are going out and you... Who was that that called you before? It begins. Da-da-dum. You're going from phase one to phase two. Oh, is she a good friend of yours? Ba-da-dum. Trouble. See, and the controlling, and jealousy is control. You see, jealousy is I want to control your behaviors with somebody else. I don't want anybody else near you because either they're going to take you away or they're going to do things to you and I'm going to have to deal with it. So jealousy is part of the beginning of this first, the ending of the first phase and the beginning of the second phase. Of phase two, which is the anxiety phase. Once you have a relationship, you know, it's great because you feel wonderful and you're happy and you feel terrific at the beginning. See, it could last a week, 2 weeks, sometimes a few years. But that initial phase, which some people call the honeymoon, but I don't because most honeymoons have long passed that phase. You know, when you're on a honeymoon, you've known a person so long, it's not really that new and exciting. But at the beginning, when you first meet a person, it's very, very exciting. Then sets in the anxiety. This phase is considered a rational turning point, which usually occurs after some kind of commitment has been made between both people. Hey, I won't go out with anybody else. You won't go out with anybody else. Hey, how would you like to live together? When you carry an illusion of intimacy, regardless of the other person's feelings, you create a belief that this person really cares for you much more than they do, maybe. You have unfounded thoughts about infidelity on the part of the partner, and you start demanding accountability for normal daily activities. Where'd you go today? You out shopping? Who'd you go with? Where'd the two of you go? Little curious questions. Overwhelming fear of abandonment, including baseless thoughts of a partner walking out on you. They're just going to walk out on you. Just going to leave you. It's phase two, anxiety. Notice the key to this is anxiety. Phase two also, over the need to constantly be in contact with a love interest via phone, email, or in person. You remember the period of the beepers? The beeper period was a great period of time in romantic history. People used to carry beepers, and they would get beeped by their love interest, not meaning that they should get returned the call, but, you know, they'd get beeped, and then they'd have to go to a phone. Cell phones are different, because nowadays you could say the cell phone didn't work, I didn't answer it, it was turned off, I was in a movie, the thing was in a subway, the beeper. was the first. It was like one of those things that babies have when you have a baby watcher. Baby monitors, yeah. It's like a baby monitor where you're monitoring your baby. You'd get beepers for your mate. And you would get husbands and wives. The husbands would walk around and they'd have beepers on their belts. And they'd have a beeper on their belt so their wife could call them at any moment. And nowadays we have the same thing. Cell phones, beepers, computers that you carry around, and you're no longer, you know, never independent. Somebody could reach you at any moment. They will never be anxious about you. In phase two, there's a lot of anxiety. And then there's this kind of continuation and escalation of controlling behaviors. Now, you may say, but that's only the crazy people do that. No. This is average folks falling in love. Phase three, the obsessive phase. This particular phase represents a rapid escalation of the unhealthy attachment style. It's at this point that the obsessive controlling behaviors reach critical mass, ultimately overwhelming the person's life. You think about them all the time. That's all you could think about. You want to control them. You want to control their behavior. You want to control what they feel. If they feel angry with you, you don't want them to feel angry. I don't want you to be angry, so you're controlling them at all times. At this kind of phase, my friends, the person is really starting to get in trouble, and it is probably now that you should make your exit, you know, when you notice it really gets bad. The onset of tunnel vision happens, meaning that the relationship, the dependent person cannot stop thinking about their love interest. They lose interest in their job, they lose interest in their school. They can't do anything else. They have a love interest, you know, and in this beginning of the obsession, you do drive-bys. You drive by the home or the workplace of your mate to make sure that they're where they're supposed to be. You call them up. And extreme control tactics, including questioning a love's interest, commitment to the relationship, guilt trips, the goal of manipulating a love interest into providing more attention. This is phase three. So listen, friends, does this sound like love? Did I not tell you? It was a mistake in the design. I love love. Love, 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 love. It's a great thing. But what a mess. This is Armand DeMille with you with a positive mind. You know, we've had a lot of time off here because we had the marathon. So I'm hyped, psyched, ready. And we're going to be taking your calls when we come back at 212-209-2900, my friends. 212-209-2900. But we're going to take first a short break, play a little music, come back. I'll give you phase four, which is the destructive phase of romance. Doesn't this all sound, this is a positive mind. Well, what's so positive here? We'll get to it. Maybe I'll turn you into a Buddhist. 212-209-2900. You can make your calls. We're going to take a short break. When I come back, a little music, and then we'll get right to your calls.
Time won't save our souls. Time won't save our souls. Time won't save my soul.
Black Rebel motorcycle gang called Shuffle Your Feet. What do you know? Who knows when I'll see you again? Well, you know, the stalker knows when they're going to see you again. They're hanging outside your window. We're going to take your calls in just a minute. Phase four, the destructive phase of romantic relationships when they become destructive. It's the final phase of the obsessional relational progression. The ORP, the ORP. It represents the destruction of the relationship due to the phase three behaviors. You see, the things that took place when people get busted in relationships and they say, oh, you cheated on me. They forgot that there were three phases right before that happened. You know, they'll say, oh, it's because he couldn't confront me with the issues. Well, whenever there is anything that's a great betrayal in a relationship, there are three things that took place before it. Phase one, phase two, phase three that you ignored. You didn't pay attention to those. You're paying attention to only phase four because you found, you know, the handkerchief in your pocket. Does anybody use handkerchiefs anymore? Yes, the men do now in their jackets, right? Pocket. It's such a nice thing, you know, somebody's weeping, you reach in your pocket and you hand them a clean white handkerchief and you tell them to keep it. Nice thing. It's gone. Gone. All right, anyway, betting back to the phase threes, you know, the first three phases. In the fourth phase, something destructive happens. A variety of reasons, this considers the most dangerous of the four phases because the person suddenly plummets into a deep depression due to the collapse of the relationship. Overwhelming feelings of depression, feeling empty inside, a sudden loss of self-esteem, extreme feelings of self-blame, self-hatred, anger, rage, and a desire to seek revenge against a love interest for betraying you, supposedly. Denial that the relationship has ended and attempting to win the loved one back could be one of the things that you do. And then, if you can't, and it's really over, the use of drugs, alcohol, food, or sex to medicate the emotional pain. So the bottom line of it is, my friends, when it goes wrong, it was going wrong at the beginning. But because you're blinded by your need for it, you can't catch it. You don't see it. Your friends may see it. They may tell you about it, but you kind of don't see it. It only happens at the end. And it's not that anybody is wrong. It's not that the person is wrong for, you know, when it winds up into a mess. It's just two blind kids who thought they were doing the best they could, and they made a mess out of their relationship. And hopefully there are no children caught in the middle of this relationship so that if you did have to break up, you could break up, you know. But usually by then it's a little too late, and your relationship has kind of progressed to the point where you have children, and now the children have to be in the mess. Okay. But they'll deal with it because they have me. They'll call me up in sometime in the future and say, you know, my mother and father, what a mess they had. And we'll help them through it and they'll be okay. This is Armand DeMille with you with the Positive Mind. We'll talk about your obsessional love. 212-209-2900. Have you obsessed in your mind? Have you been crazy in love with somebody? 212-209-2900. Let's take one of your calls. Hi, you're on the air. This is Armand DeMille. We're going to get that. It's always the first call after a month.
Hello?
It is. Hi there.
Oh, hi. I didn't realize I was on the air. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm listening to your show, and it's very interesting. It's touching me in many ways because currently my wife is divorcing me after 22 years of marriage. And it's funny because she was obsessed with me to begin with.
Yeah.
And I was not. But it was intriguing and infatuating to have someone so infatuated with you. And we got married, and now it's 22 years later, and she's divorcing me. And I'm finding it very difficult. And to tell you the truth, between the two of us, I'm the controlling one and have always been. And that's a product of my upbringing, I think, unfortunately. But I'm having difficulty at this point in time dealing with... number one, I have a small son, a young son. I also have an older daughter who's in college, but I'm having trouble losing him, what I feel like it'll be losing him, because obviously he'll be with his mother, and I'll be alienated from them. And that part is really kind of tearing me up.
Sure, it all tears you up. You know, like you said, you're a controlling guy. 22 years, something must have triggered the end. Is she have another relationship?
No, it's been being triggered for a while. And honestly, I called you probably years ago, a few years ago.
Your voice sounded familiar, yes.
Yeah, and, you know, if you look at it on the surface, you would say that it's my fault because when we get into discussions that turn into arguments, after a period of an hour or so, I become ignorant and say things that I regret saying and have apologized for. But
so have the two of you sought out counseling, couples counseling? I bet you've done very little stuff, like once or twice.
No. Mostly separately, unfortunately. We have tried that, but mostly separately, and I didn't think it was... It turned out not to be fruitful, obviously, because it was just a sounding board for each of our gripes, and never together. We tried it once together, and it was so heated, and the gentleman we saw couldn't control us, and therefore we decided to see him separately, and that was it. And
that's such a mistake. You know, the therapist that does that makes such a mistake. If he can't control the heat... You know what I mean? Get away from them. You know, I mean, I know many couples therapists, and I'll tell you, since he got a child involved, since his 22 years relationship, if it's not unsolvable, you know, it at least you two should be do one thing. You should become friends. Now, this friendship becomes vitally important in the separation, number one, in the taking care of your son, number two, and number three, in a potential, possible, airing out what really is wrong and possibly making it work between the two of you. But the thing you need most is a friendship counselor. See, you don't need a marriage counselor. You need a friendship counselor. You and she have got to be friends. And you've got to work towards that. Now, I may have said it to you 12 years ago when you called me. I'll say it again. Get a good counselor. Get somebody who you could see who's not afraid of feelings. Let it get as heated as it gets. You're not going to scare me. You could see me. And if you yelled and screamed, I'd probably just hug you. Because it doesn't... I expect overreactions when I see people.
Yeah.
So get to a good counselor. I know...
Where do you find somebody good?
I know about four excellent, excellent therapists. Family therapists. What?
In New Jersey?
I know of one in New Jersey, and I know of two in New Jersey and two in New York, who I consider the best there is.
How can I get names of the
Call my office. I'll give you a call back, and I'll give you some names, okay?
Okay, what's your office?
212-757-4488.
Great. Thanks, Amar.
Sure. You know, this whole idea of erotomania... is this thing, you know, we're going to just give it a moment. Erotomania is a rare, it's a thing in which a person holds a delusional belief that another person, again, usually of a higher status, is in love with them. But this is not new. Aristotle talked about this. Aristotle talked about it. Then a Frenchman named Jacques Ferrat in 1623 gave it such a wonderful name. He called it La Maladie d'amour, right? Lovesick. And then he called it melancholy erotique, the erotic melancholy. That really fits it, you know, both of them together, maladies d'amour, melancholy erotique, put them all together, put all four words together, and you get exactly what it feels like. An erotic melancholy that's a malady of more. Maladie d'amour, that sounds like a song, you know? Maladie d'amour. 212-209-2900. Let's take one of your calls. Hi there, you're on the air. It's a beeper. Okay, 212-209-2900. Let's take another call. Hi there, you're on the air. This is Armand DeMille.
Good afternoon, Armand. How are you?
Good. Who is this?
This is Aida.
Hello, Aida.
This is Aida that used to work at your office, Aida.
Aida, how are you? How
wonderful
to talk to you.
How
nice, how fantastic.
Voice.
Oh, my gosh, you're a wonderful human being.
Oh, thank you, and you as well. It
one
was
of the best
a
people
pleasure
I
hearing
ever
your
met.
Voice today.
Yeah, how are you, Aida? How's everything
good.
Going?
Great, wonderful. Marriage in the South is treating me quite well, and I hope I'm doing the same for it. And
the South is treating you well?
Yes, I've moved, actually.
And where are you?
I'm in Durham, North Carolina now.
Hey, great.
Yeah, so I'm home actually just to visit some family, and I had a wedding, and I said, my mom said, okay, Armand is on. So we were listening to the show, and I
through the computer you're listening?
No, actually, I'm on the radio. I'm here in New York now for.
Oh, you're in New York.
Yeah, for a couple of weeks.
Because you can hear it down there on the computer nowadays.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, I'll have to make sure I log on and do that.
Yeah. Well, it's really nice to hear from you. Your child is well?
Well, no babies. Not yet.
Your husband is well.
My husband is well, yes. Yeah. Yes, he's doing just fine. And I actually have a question for you.
Sure.
While I'm on the air.
Are you going to stop by my office so I can say hello?
I will. I stopped by the last time I was here, but you were, I think, in a session. So.
Yeah.
I will make sure I do that this time.
I
leave on
it.
Monday, so you'll be there tomorrow?
No.
No?
All right, it'll be the next time.
Next time, but I'll make sure I call beforehand.
Good. Okay, Aida, so ask me your question.
Okay, the question is about, and I don't know if there's anything so-called, but mental stalking. Is there a way that you can be attached to a person mentally and not necessarily disconnect from them in an emotional state?
Well, give me an example. You mean you meet a man and...
Well, you say you're in a relationship, for an example, and I'll use myself for an example because
okay.
That's who I'm referring to. I was in a relationship prior to my marriage, and it was great and good, but got cut short due to other circumstances. And it was, you know, emotionally, I guess, good for me. And so, to some degree, it's almost like a child losing its favorite toy, and you're kind of still attached to it.
Yes.
And so now that I'm in a marriage, my marriage is wonderful, and I love my husband, and everything's great, and I have my emotional attachment to this, but I still think about a lot of the good things that I experienced in that relationship and sometimes ponder maybe a little bit too much.
What is the thing in particular that you had in the other relationship that was so great?
The flexibility of life. We just enjoyed life differently.
So nowadays, as an adult,
yes.
Mature, married woman,
yes.
You are more responsible, doing responsible things.
Yes.
And it must be tedious to be responsible for a house and taking care of things and all the stuff you're doing. And you yearn for the days when you were free.
Yes.
When you felt that freedom.
And you could travel and do different things.
Absolutely.
And
you have attached to that.
Yes.
This person with whom you felt it. So what you're yearning for, Aida, is not the man.
No.
You're yearning for the free Aida.
Yes.
You see?
Mm-hmm.
You're yearning for you. And what you have is a symbol of you, which is embodied in the relationship with this other guy.
Okay.
You're looking for the free Aida. And I'm going to tell you, find that. It's there. Because as long as I've known you, you've been one of the freest spirits, even though you're one of the totally most responsible people I ever met.
Oh, what?
You ran my office. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And
so
you are still free of spirit.
Okay.
Are you still deeply religious?
I am.
Yes.
I am.
So where does that sense of freedom fit in with the deep religiosity?
Well, I guess I have to think about that a little bit more.
Yeah, because it's, I think it's part of a conflict.
Yes.
You're Muslim.
I am.
And Muslim and freedom have a little bit of an antagonism together.
Mm.
Don't they?
Well, yes.
The free
I guess
spirit,
based on individual
the free travel.
Interpretation. Yeah. So I definitely appreciate that because it does bring some things into perspective. And I guess now I understand, you know, that freedom doesn't necessarily mean letting go of, or holding on to the thought of it, but actually doing it. So I'll make sure I practice that and strive really hard to get
find
that back.
Freedom.
I will.
Okay, nice to talk to you. I hope to
Thank
see you the
you
next time much. Around, Aida.
Yes, great. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you. Okay. 212-209-2900, Melody D'Amour. So we get this feeling, you know, when you meet somebody and you have, like, the best sexual experience of your life, and then from then on you go, you know, you get married and you have an average sexual experience, which is in a marriage, you know, once every 2 years or something like that. You know, and then yeah, or once a month or once every week or whatever it is, but it's kind of ordinary in the same position, same no change, you know, kind of the direct way. And you yearn for your sexually free self, the part of you that was wild and abandoned, and so you attach it to the partner you had who did these wild, abandoned things with you, and you think what you yearn for is that old partner. It's not. You're yearning for yourself. You're yearning to find the part of yourself. 212-209-2900. Let me take another call. This is Armand DeMille. Hi, you're on the air.
How you doing?
Good.
Good. Is it Jim from Brooklyn?
Hello, Jim.
How you doing? I'm recently separated, I guess for last year, and this last, I've been with this girl for the last 6 months, and we just found out she's pregnant, and she has a really, I don't know, we're really in love, and I just don't know how to tell my ex or future ex.
I don't think I really understand. You have two relationships?
Right now I'm separated. I've been married for probably like 10 years. We're
okay.
Separated.
You're separated. And
right. I've been seeing this girl for the last year. And we just found out she's pregnant.
Uh-huh.
And she don't want to go for a divorce, my ex, my separated wife. And I don't know how to go about it. You know what I'm saying?
Does your current relationship want to be married?
She does in the near future, yes.
In the near future, is there any pressure around the baby? I know it's difficult. Now, let me just ask you something. What in your imagination is going to happen, what in your mind is going to happen when you tell your spouse about the fact that you have a woman who's pregnant that you're in love with?
Oh, she's going to flip out. She's not going to be happy at all, and she don't want to go for a divorce as it is, and this is just going to be icing on the cake.
Okay, so when she flips out, how is she going to flip out? How do you imagine?
She's going to be very, I have two kids with her, so she's going to hold the kids for me, and God knows what else. I just don't know.
There it is right there, right? She's going to hold the kids for ransom. She's going to blackmail you in some way using the children is what you fear the most.
Yes.
Yeah, this is another counseling situation. This is another situation where you've got to do something in the middle of it. And I know everybody would tell you, just be honest, just deal with it as you got to deal with it. But if you have the kind of person who would do that, right, you're going to have to dance around it. And it might require you finding a counselor once again. And what I would suggest is that you talk to your spouse about being able to form a better relationship with her, even though the two of you are separating. And what you would do is the two of you would go into counseling, and somewhere while you're in counseling, maybe 3 weeks into it or 4 weeks into it, then you say what it is so that you could have somebody there to help you deal with it.
Well, she knows I'm with this woman right now, and she wouldn't be up for counseling. She's more on a jealous type right now, you know what I'm saying?
She wouldn't be up for counseling for the kid's sake.
I don't believe so. She's too bitter right now over the relationship.
Yeah, I understand. I understand. I'm sorry you got to deal with it, but it is part of the hard knocks that you got to have, you know? I mean, so you go through it, and your kids will go through it, and she'll hold the kids back, and the kids will recover from it, and they'll realize that they really have a dad that's of value eventually. And even though you'll be separated from them somewhat for a little period of time, it will work out. So integrity, really, if at all possible, go for the truth and deal with the consequences. Sure.
All right, thanks a lot.
Okay, Jim. 212-209-2900. This is Armand DeMille. Taking a few calls, talking about romantic relationships. And as you could hear from people, you know, pain. I'm telling you, I don't know who invented this thing. If there was really Eros up there or Venus, I wish they would have rethought their design. 212-209-2900. Maybe if they had just developed friendship first, you know, that first, made that a higher value, and then love second, that would have been really nice. 212-209-2900. Let's take another call. Hi, this is Armand DeMille. You're on the air. Hello there.
Armand.
Yes.
How are you?
Good.
This is Tony.
Tony.
I love your show today. I went through the same thing similar to what a gentleman just went through. They had spoke a minute ago.
Yeah, the breakup and...
Yeah.
Are you Tony from the theater?
No. I live in the Bronx.
Oh, Tony from the Bronx. Hi, Tony.
Yeah. But my question, I have actually a question for you. Is that I hear so many fathers that are breaking up, and I hear them say that their wife will hold them, their kids for ransom. I don't understand that. Don't fathers have legal rights to their children?
Sure they do.
So why do guys allow it to happen?
Didn't it happen with your mother and father?
No.
Didn't your mom talk bad about your father?
Oh, no, yes, that. But I'm talking about the
okay,
legal...
but let me ask you about that. Hold on a second. When your mom talked bad about your dad to you, what did you feel?
I didn't have much of that.
Oh, but what did you feel when you got it? You see, what happens with a child is loyalties. When a child becomes part of a broken relationship, the one that they're left behind with has a tremendous power because you sleep with that kid. That kid is there every minute, every day. Yes, there are all kinds of legal things you could do. There's all kinds of resolution. You could go to the courts. You could do all kinds of things. But really, the child is left behind with the mama, and if the mama wants to wreak revenge on the father, she will turn the kid. Most children will listen at the beginning because they're so shaken up by the separation itself that they listen at first, you see.
I understand what you're saying, but my point is, why do fathers so easily walk away? Why do you have to walk away, period, is my question.
You mean...
You have to stay there and fight and deal, and you separate, but you stay there and you are a father throughout the separation. Why do they walk away?
Are you saying the important thing? Because some of them don't want to be even part. They don't want to be fathers anymore, many of them.
I understand that, and that's my point. They hide behind the law.
Yeah.
Because I went through the same thing, and I just never walked away, no matter what. I never walked away, ever.
Yeah.
Nice. And I'm not saying this to brag. I'm just saying this that, you know, fathers who are listening, is there's no, you know, you just got to stay there, no matter what.
Stay there, hang in there, and deal with it.
You know, you created this mess. Deal with it, but don't let that be an excuse not to be in your child's life weekly.
Nice
daily.
Going. Nice going, Tony. Thank you very much for calling in. And this is Armand DeMille. We've got to be going. I mean, quite a guy, you know. So if you want a copy of today's program, you can get it on the Internet by going to thepositivemind.com or... www.bai.org. Either one of the two, sometimes BAI.org website works. And if not, thepositivemind.com. And send me an email about your romantic experience, Armand, Armand, at brainlink.com. But watch out for those kisses at the bottom.